Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
Welcome back to the week that was, and what a week it's been. From a sudden wobble in AI stocks, Michael Burry announcing now infamous short on Nvidia and Palantir, cooling gold prices, to the G20's inequality report that's probably raising more questions than eyebrows at the moment. And of course, all eyes, speaking of eyebrows, now turn to next week's medium-term budget. Joining me as always to unpack it all, Warwick Lucas, a private client's portfolio manager at Vernani, and Professor Raymond Parsons from the Northwest University Business School. And Raymond, I've got to say, with a new academic feather in your cap at the University of Western Cape.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm now an extraordinary professor in the School of Economics and Business Sciences at that university, and I'm looking forward to combining the two challenges of Northwest and the University of the Western Cape.
A bridge between the North and the South, and hopefully the left and the right when it comes to the composition academically at the university. But well done, Professor. Very proud of the achievement, and great to have that feather in your cap, like I said. Warwick, let's just start globally. The market darling that was AI seems to have really, shall we say, caught its breath or had a wobble this week. Nvidia pulled back. We saw Palantir get hammered after some pretty good results, but it's still trading in the kind of stratosphere. We saw some heavy selling across the AI supply chain. It came back a little towards the end of the week. Are we looking at a healthy correction here, a bit of profit taking before year end, or are the cracks in this whole AI story finally showing?
Michael, so when we look at the AI story, I mean, there's a question of developers and then there's a question of users and those that sort of benefits kind of spin off. Now, when we're talking about the developers, we're largely talking about the Mag 7, which are collectively between them spending capex of just shy of $400 billion US a year, which is obviously a lot of money. And certainly in terms of returns, it's a very, very long way away before we see any kind of economic return on that capex. And I think we're also in the situation that it's almost existential for them. They all feel that they have to compete. They don't have a choice. It's win or die. So they're kind of locked into a ferocious capex cycle here. That said, I mean, most of those businesses, unlike the train smashers of 1998, the previous tech bubble, they are serious businesses. They have big balance sheets, they have got big cash flows, and they can take a lot of pummeling before they start rolling over. I think one of the key problems, of course, with AI as well, perhaps in the fullness of time, and especially if returns don't come, we might start getting some nonsensical accounting and all sorts. But in the meantime, there are lots of people outside that benefit from AI. I mean, you and I do. We help it to do projects for us, and we benefit. We have an economic benefit from it. Other companies use it and have a benefit. And we are in a rate-cutting cycle. And I mean, when in the US, look, they might have rising inflation somewhat there, but there is a bit of a cushion. Look, bull markets don't die of old age. They eventually get put down by a vet from a reserve bank. But in the meantime, there's enough to keep things tracking along for now. So I don't think there's a systemic problem, but it's going to be one of many pauses in a very, very frothy market with, for now anyway, very poor economics.
I think very well summed up, Warwick. And I was having a look at the AI economy in the US. AI was mentioned during the S&P 500 earnings calls this quarter for over 10,000 times. For the first time in history, that figure has doubled over the last 18 months. The previous record of 9,000 was set at the end of the June quarter. And to put that into perspective, AI was cited just 1,000 times during the three-month period to the end of March of 2023. So AI really is everything now when you look at the way companies are thinking about the future. And to your point, Warwick, there is utility, there is value. And I still think we're at the very early stages of finding out the network effects of the value and the ripple effects and second order effects of where other people might discover value from it. Raymond, from a macro lens, we see markets shrug off an awful lot. They climb a wall of worry, as they say. They've shrugged off inflation, trade issues, sticky interest rates until now. Does this sudden tech tremor suggest that investors are starting to reassess the fundamentals, or is it just a bit of a year-end bout of nerves before we see central banks starting to cut in earnest next year? And of course, we've got the US-China trade tensions in the background to all of this in the Supreme Court review.
Hi, Michael. Look, I think if we take the big picture, generally it seems to me that when we look at the financial markets, they seem to combine a resilience with a volatility in more or less equal proportions. And it's very hard to navigate from week to week which of the factors are going to prevail. So I'd like to single out what I think in the past week has been what I call the big ticket item, which was the trade agreement, or at least arrangement, between the US and China, between the two presidents, which has certainly put the gold price back into perspective. It seems to me that indeed the gold price boom is probably over for now. But what has been the achievement of that agreement? I think the agreement is both sides want time. It's not over. It's not the last we've heard of the tension in trade matters between the US and China, but they've bought time. And that's important for both of them to decide what adaptive strategies they might want to follow. And just bear in mind that exactly in 1 year's time, when this 1 year extra time expires, is also the date of the midterm elections in the US. On the Supreme Court, I think they may well rule negatively, but I think we must understand that Trump has other legal options under other legislation in order to, in fact, implement on the trade front, you know, what he might want. So while it might be a setback politically or symbolically, it's not necessarily going to shut him down, you know, on the trade front. So I think what's important for me in the past week, rather than the vagaries of the short-term financial markets, is the interesting survey of CEOs, of the global CEOs, which the KPMG survey released in the last day or so, where the global CEOs are saying they have the lowest confidence in the world economy that they've had in 5 years because of the geopolitical tensions, the economic uncertainties, and the trade shocks that come and go. It's interesting that the African CEOs are more optimistic because they see some opportunities here. But I think the important point is this is the real economy. These are the people who are taking decisions about investment, about jobs, and about supply chains. So I think it's very important that we understand that although the outlook for the world economy is a little more benign and not as bad as it might have seemed to the IMF and indeed others in the past few months, there are still a number of vulnerabilities, number of things that can still go wrong. And I think that's an important message we must take, both from what's happening in the financial markets, but also the views of the CEOs who have to take the real economy decisions.
I wonder what they were saying about inequality, because that sparked a lot of debate. Warwick, this new G20 report on global inequality chaired by Joseph Stiglitz, claiming that 83% of countries representing 90% of the world's population are now highly unequal. It did look a bit odd, you know, one of those lies, and damn statistics type things. Warwick, you've gone through the numbers and your analysis calls the report out for what you term a cooked statistic. Walk us through why the math doesn't math.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of Joseph Stiglitz, I mean, he was, after all, the chairman. I'm not so sure that he's one of the authors, but the rest of the authors I don't know about and probably shouldn't. The problem is very simple. They have taken a data set called the World Inequality Data Set, and they've then used an entirely different threshold, which is the World Bank. Now, Genies are anything but consistent. There's Genies and there's Genies. And the Gini produced by the World Bank is a very different calculation compared to the guinea that gets put out by the WRD. And in fact, the difference is in the order of 50%. So, for example, if you take a data item from the WRD, you know, it's kind of like you're saying someone weighs 80 kilograms, but hey, they must lose weight because they're actually weighing 120. It's rubbish and it's wrong. It's flat out wrong. You can't use one data set and then use somebody else's benchmark. And as an aside, the WRD, in fact, does not have a distinction between high, low, and medium. So the simple fact of the matter is they've used wrong data, full stop. And they've interpreted it incorrectly.
I mean, let's just look at it very simplistically, Warwick. If you were to say that, okay, 83% of countries representing 90% of the world's population, that has to include China and India. Because, you know,
Well,
are China and India deeply unequal societies?
According to the World Bank, no. But according to the WRD, using the incorrect benchmark, yes. And I mean, straight away, that flags one of the problems.
Yeah.
Because when the World Bank put out their study on inequality using their 0.4 benchmark, I mean, it was a completely different result. I mean, it was, I don't have the number immediately to hand, but it was a far lesser number that was completely or badly unequal. So, I mean, there was just a complete mismatch here.
From that perspective, Raymond, I want to bring you in because this report lands at a time when global cooperation feels brittle. The call here is for a permanent global inequality panel, a kind of IPCC for economics. It sounds noble, but I worry because of the politicization that we've seen with the IPCC. But do you see this as genuine reform or institutional overreach here by the G20?
Well, Michael, I think I'd like to make three general points and then just a couple of specific points for South Africa. The first is what this report shows to me again is the dangers of single issue research showing no concept of any trade-offs in the real world and where you have to make policies which are fair and balanced and efficient. And I think that's an important omission. And it's inevitable when you set a term of reference so narrow that it only hangs on one peg. Secondly, the facts seem to be threaded on a ideological string. And this, of course, raises questions about its credibility and whether the panel was representative enough to offer a more balanced view. And thirdly, it's distinctly anti-business. There's no doubt about it. If you read it carefully, it is anti-business. It's not towards the role of market forces and the role that obviously business must play as part of the growth and investment process, which is needed in the long term in order to reduce inequality. So the issue coming back to South Africa is certainly, I hope that the B20, not the G20, but the B20, which is the business flow supporting the G20, will interrogate this report because it certainly doesn't chime in with what they are going to be reporting. Secondly, we have the GNU, we've got the National Development Plan, we've got the Medium-Term Development Plan. They try to strike a balance between reform, upliftment, economic growth, economic efficiency. The boundary between the public and the private sector has shifted more towards mobilizing the private sector in order to get outcomes that will, among other things, reduce inequality in South Africa over time through inclusive growth. So I think the big issue is that the gap between what is being said by this inequality report and what South Africa is already committed to, if it wants a bigger, stronger, and better economy, it's a wide gap because what we are now engaged in and not doing as successfully in any way as we ought to be doing, we don't need another intervention which is threatening to push the whole debate in another level. So I think it's very important that we challenge and interrogate what is in this report and only pick out those points that for South Africa support what we are already committed to doing in terms of existing reform and growth policies to get the business confidence, the investor confidence, the investment you need in order to do the better things we want to see for the South African economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to weigh in there as well, Michael.
Please do.
What Raymond says about single need is absolutely very important. I mean, you know, we get the preemptive note at the beginning of this report carries on about how important inequality is. But can it really be more important than poverty? People not having enough water, not having shelter, not having food, and not even any basic services. I mean, surely that is far more important than so-called inequality. So it seems to me that they're kind of looking to try and prioritize equality over poverty. I mean, that's like trying to prioritize envy over need. I mean, it's just silly.
Yeah. And I mean, I think inequality is not in and of itself necessarily bad. I mean, inequality is often treated as a moral failing or a policy failure. But I think the reality is far more nuanced than that, because some inequality is natural or inevitable and even desirable in a dynamic opportunity-based economy. For if you work in a functioning market economy, people who work longer hours, take entrepreneurial risks, acquire scarce skills, innovate and create value will end up with higher incomes or wealth. And that's a kind of inequality of differentiation. That's not an injustice. So, I mean, to me, it misdiagnoses the thing. And to Warwick's point entirely, we've got to be saying there's good inequality and there's bad inequality. I think inequality by itself is not the enemy. Inequality with mass poverty is, and we've got to have a look at what is the cause of mass poverty. In the South African context, we're not creating an economy that is very favorable to business, and business creates jobs and lifts people out of poverty. And again, I can see this report being used to stick as a stick to bludgeon business with Raymond.
Absolutely.
Well, that's why I hope that business, through the B20 and through, of course, Business Unity South Africa and others, will engage. Don't dismiss this report as, well, that's just an academic exercise. It could have real impact. So nonetheless, you need to engage with those ideas and show them to be wrong. But above all, you need to retain consistency and confidence in the good things we are supposedly already committed to.
The other thing is, when this gets regenerated, they need it to be done by someone who can actually do the numbers properly. I mean, if you actually look at the most equal societies according to these various measures, all of them are basically slow growth European economies doddering along at about 1% per annum growth. And a big part of that is, of course, because they've got demographic problems, which means that they have small workforces. Therefore, their workers have a lot of negotiating power, and therefore their pay packets are distorted upwards. But that's a demographic thing, not an inequality versus equality thing. It's a completely different phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it also shows no understanding or insight as to how you actually calculate these genes. They're messy things.
Yeah.
And to then try and use those to lie, no, we can't tolerate it.
Gentlemen, I really enjoyed that. Thank you very much. These kinds of things need to be called out for the pseudo poppycock that they actually are at the end of the day. Yes, we've got to engage them, but only so much as you engage an offensive smelling turd that you find on the side of the road by stepping neatly over it and around it and never turning to look at it again. Thank you very much. That's all the time we have for the week that was here on Classic Business.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.